It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On December 24th, a fire at the Clairton Coke Works seriously damaged pollution control equipment, leading to many exceedances of federal air quality standards for sulfur dioxide in the Mon Valley. It's the most recent in a series of incidents at that plant. Today, we are joined by Jackie Bonomo, president and CEO of Penn Future, a statewide nonprofit environmental advocacy organization celebrating its 20th anniversary year. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me on Penn Future, Kevin.
All right, Penn Future. And, you know, 20th anniversary year. Has the mission changed at all?
It really hasn't. So Penn Future has been around fighting for clean air, clean water, and a healthy climate on behalf of the citizens of Pennsylvania for the last 20 years. I think if anything has changed, it's possibly the fact that we tend to look more at environmental issues through the lens of climate because of the exacerbation of the climate crisis on the planet right now. But fundamentally, our job is to ensure that the citizens of Pennsylvania have the clean air and the clean water that our state constitution allows us to have.
Clean air. So let's focus on that because you've been keeping a close eye on what's gone on at the Clairton Coke Works, not just since December, but before that as well. Clairton Coke Works is the largest coke producing facility in the nation. I was curious, do you sort of research other major coke producing regions in the country? And if so, do they have similar environmental issues that you're aware of?
You know, by and large, other regions of the country that have coke or have had coke in the past and steel making have done a remarkably good job in terms of complying with federal law and protecting and improving air quality in those places. The problem is that we have not been successful doing that here in Western Pennsylvania and in the Mon Valley. And I think that the fire, the catastrophic fire and incidents on December 24th was a real wake-up call to not only regulators, the environmental community, the community surrounding the coke works at Clairton, right. That the time has come for U.S. Steel to be held accountable to its legacy of pollution at Clairton Coke Works. And Penn Future has been very focused on what's been happening there for a long time. But things have changed a little bit. And we've recently launched our Toxic Neighbor campaign.
Right.
This campaign is designed to give voice to the citizens around the region who want to hold U.S. Steel accountable and have their voices be heard.
Right. County Health Department fined U.S. Steel $2 million since last June for a series of violations at Clairton. But since then, we have seen a 50% drop in emissions violations. That's from the fourth quarter of 2017 to the same period of 2018. Do you think U.S. Steel was on the right path if the fire hadn't occurred, since the drop in violations by nearly 50% from one year to another?
U.S. Steel has been on the wrong path for decades, and they are polluting almost daily. And when they pollute, they are polluting excessively on a regular basis. And the data plays that out, as well as the fines, the enforcement actions that we've seen just really snowballing over the course of the last 9 months. So for all intents and purposes, U.S. Steel continues to pay to pollute. They obviously consider this to be a privilege of sorts. And the time has come for U.S. Steel to begin to pay so that the region, the steel workers, the community, public health, and the environment can prosper. So we're really looking for a switch in the way that they approach their business. And part of that includes our looking for them to make much more significant investments and permanent solutions at Clairton.
All right. I'm going to talk about those solutions and the fines a bit. And the number of exceedances, violations dropped from 149 to 75. Are some leaks of coke oven gas inevitable in a facility like this, or just don't accept the inevitability if they are?
Steelmaking is a dirty business. Coking is a dirty operation. But the most polluting batteries at Clairton, the batteries that we're essentially asking for U.S. Steel to close, have been in place since 1918. They were refurbished in the mid-50s. And U.S. Steel made commitments as recently, several times over the course of the last 10 years, to close those batteries. So the inevitability of a dirty industry is there, but we deserve in this region a 21st century steelmaking and coking operation. It is time for U.S. Steel to really look at a significant modernization and rebuild of that facility so that facility can persist into the future, but operate in a way that provides jobs, positive public health, and a healthy environment.
Mm-hmm. In the past, Penn Future has been critical of how the County Health Department and U.S. Steel resolved violations, emissions violations. Are fines enough, or are they not enough of a deterrent from Penn Future's point of view?
Well, fines aren't enough. Let's start at the very beginning. The industry needs to obey the laws. I mean, let's start there. That's not happening. And so we are very pleased with some of the recent actions taken by the health department. In addition to the fines, the enforcement actions that they have taken, particularly the one from June of 2018, that feels like a very important step. So in addition to fines, there's accountability when the law is not being obeyed, and there's much more that U.S. Steel could be doing. So in addition to that, you know, they very much aspire to be a good corporate citizen. What does that mean? I think that's something that we endeavor to find out as part of our Toxic Neighbor campaign. So right now, U.S. Steel is in the midst of a $2 billion asset revitalization campaign. They are making investments, significant investments elsewhere. $750 million in their flagship plant in Gary, Indiana, which Mon Valley Coke essentially feeds. $250,000 in a facility in Alabama that will create 150 new jobs. What about that other $1 billion? Where is that going to be spent?
Well, let me follow up there. Sure. Because, as you mentioned, some of these batteries are very old, refurbished 50, 60 years ago. I believe they replaced one about 5 years ago. But the point is I understand the cost of replacing one is as much as $500 million. So it is an expensive proposition to upgrade to a cleaner producing Coke battery.
It's an expensive proposition, but it's not an unrationable or unreasonable ask to ask a facility and a corporation that's been active here in Western Pennsylvania for over 100 years to make a significant investment to ensure that not only that industry can persist and those jobs can remain, but that once and for all, we get this air quality cleaned up and public health turned around. The cancers, the asthmas, the heart incidences in Clairton and the Mon Valley communities are unabidable at this point. And there's no reason that in the 21st century, an industry that has both the assets and hopefully the wherewithal can do better.
Is there a sustainable solution that would clean up there, that would reduce or eliminate the emissions without negatively impacting the steelmaking business, which has been a vital part of industry both here and across this country?
So I think it all starts with closing those dirtiest batteries. I mean, we've got to get this dealt with. These batteries have been around for a long time. They continue to pollute. They continue to violate existing law. The question is then, what does a 21st century steelmaking and coking industry look like? I frankly think that that answer has to come from a combination of U.S. Steel. I mean, they're the experts. But I think that the industry also has to open its doors to conversations and innovations that are potentially available and resources that are available to us here in the region. There has to be a way to do this more sustainably. We know that electric arc furnaces are becoming more prevalent in the steel industry elsewhere. I don't know if that's the case for U.S. Steel's operation, but electric arc furnaces are cleaner, they're easier to regulate, they're more efficient than the kind of operation that we have here in the Mon Valley.
We have just about a minute left. And I wanted to ask you, has the health department been too lenient? Do they have the teeth to try to enforce the regulations more effectively?
The health department and the county have really stepped up their game in the course of the last 9 months, and the enforcement actions, the fines, and their willingness to go toe-to-toe with U.S. Steel in court is something that's been very positive. I'd like to also just say to the citizens of Western Pennsylvania to please go to toxicneighbor.org and find out more about what you can do to help.
All right. In our last 30 seconds, fines are expected as a result of the December 24th. What are you going to keep your eye on in the future regarding this?
We're going to keep our eye on the data that U.S. Steel files that's going to continue to reveal violations of pollution, and we're going to hold them accountable. We hope that your listeners will help us do the same.
Jackie Bonomo is the CEO and president of Penn Future. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks again for having me on Penn Future.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities are getting more say in setting tuition rates as part of a broader effort to stabilize the state system of higher education in the face of declining enrollment, rising costs, and stagnant state funding. Will this tuition flexibility help students and parents plan for the cost of education? What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh City Council debates spending $15,000 to bring the national balloon races to the city in 1928. The annual military ballooning festival held by the National Aeronautical Association was an elimination race held Memorial Day weekend. 14 competitors signed up for the contest, but the afternoon of the first races, the entrants encountered severe thunderstorms. Two aeronauts were killed by lightning and two others were hurt by the storm. The winner of the contest was called Navy No. 1 and flew nearly 600 miles. The race would return the next year to Pittsburgh. Amateur ballooning remains a popular pastime throughout Pennsylvania. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last October, a gunman entered the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, killing 11 people and wounding 7 others. On Tuesday, Mayor Bill Peduto signed legislation that would ban the use of weapons like one that was used that day. While some celebrated the new restrictions, others are fighting them in court. 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy has more.
Pittsburgh tried to regulate assault-style rifles over 20 years ago, but the courts rejected those laws. State judges ruled that gun laws can only be regulated by the state's capital of Harrisburg. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto says they're tired of waiting.
So what we're saying is, in communities across this state, in townships and boroughs and in cities, we will take action.
City officials originally sought an outright ban on assault-style rifles and some types of ammunition and accessories within city limits. The resistance was immediate.
We will not comply! We will not comply!
We will not comply. That's what hundreds of protesters chanted in January outside of Pittsburgh's City Hall. Many were strapped with the weapons that would be banned by the law. The protesters say the gun laws aren't legal. Gun rights activist Justin Dillon organized that rally. He says laws like this are a political stunt.
If a politician really cared about its people, or people in general, they would have done something before the synagogue shooting and not waited for a tragedy to happen.
Elected officials agree only the state can regulate firearm possession. So in March, they came up with a new strategy, banning the use, not the ownership, of the guns. City Councilor Corey O'Connor introduced the bill and its amendments.
I think they're on the run, and this is the first time that more and more, not just cities, but more and more elected officials and communities are starting to fight back.
The new law offers a broad definition of use. It restricts several types of weapons and bans having loaded guns within city limits. That means many of the protesters who opposed the law at the January rally would have been breaking it. Dillon admits his gun was loaded.
Absolutely. It's kind of pointless not to have a gun that's loaded.
The National Rifle Association and other gun rights groups filed multiple lawsuits Tuesday. Together, they accused the city of a number of wrongful acts. One suit says the city is violating a court settlement from 1995, the last time the city tried but failed to regulate assault-style weapons. The NRA says the city can't limit the size of magazines used in guns. In a statement, the NRA said residents, quote, have a right to carry the self-defense tools that best suit their needs. Peduto says in order to have new gun laws, he's prepared to go to court.
Yes, we'll take on lawsuits, because lawsuits are the action of the gun manufacturing lobby. They threaten anybody who would dare have a voice in what and how guns are to be used in our society.
Not every local official agrees with it. Three of the council's 9 members voted against it. And in January, District Attorney Steven Zappala told City Council they don't have the power to regulate guns. The city's law will go into effect in 60 days, if a judge allows it to stand. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania recently released a plan to encourage residents to buy more electric cars. These battery-run vehicles require electric charging stations. But in Japan, the future of electric cars might look very different. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports the country and its automakers are betting big on something else.
Mirai means future in Japanese. It's also the name of Toyota's hydrogen-powered fuel cell car.
You see, this is the engine noise of this car. So quiet.
I'm driving with my translator, Hiro Sasso, west of Tokyo, hoping to spot Mount Fuji. The Mirai doesn't look that different from a regular sedan. Still, after we park at the overlook, one man, Tadashi Hirano, spots the hydrogen sign on the car and wants to check under the hood. We explain that unlike a combustion engine that burns gasoline, a hydrogen fuel cell doesn't burn anything. It uses a chemical reaction between the hydrogen and the oxygen from the air to produce electricity. The only emission out of this electric car's tailpipe is water. As Hirano looks beneath the hood of the Mirai for the first time, we ask him what he thinks.
Do you want to buy this? Tempted to buy?
Maybe.
Right now, it's too expensive for him, even with a generous government subsidy that brings it down from the equivalent of $70,000 to $50,000. Toyota says the price will drop as production ramps up. At the LFA Works factory in Toyota City, workers install the carbon fiber hydrogen tanks on a new Mirai. These are all assembled by hand, only about 10 each day. Taiyo Kawai helps develop fuel cell infrastructure for Toyota. Kawai says right now Japan relies heavily on Middle East oil, but hydrogen is abundant and the fuel could be produced anywhere. Toyota and other car makers like Honda and Hyundai are also banking on the fact that hydrogen fuel cell cars could be more convenient. Yoshikazu Tanaka is Toyota's chief engineer. Tanaka says filling up a car with hydrogen is easier and faster than charging a battery on an electric vehicle. It may make more sense for people who live in dense cities or apartment buildings and who don't have a convenient place to plug in. A tank of hydrogen also gets you farther than a fully charged battery, which makes it more efficient for trucks and buses. There are only about 11,000 fuel cell vehicles on the road worldwide. About half of those are in California. But Toyota is playing the long game, planning decades into the future. The big challenge today, though, is it's not easy to find hydrogen fuel.
So our first order of business now is to fill up the tank.
Yeah, fill up the tank.
Back in Tokyo, we search for a hydrogen station online. When we find one, it has a big H2 sign.
Nobody's here. It's just us.
In a pouring rain, the station attendant, Ken Kawakatsu, explains that the hydrogen gas is cooled to minus 35 degrees Celsius. It's so cold, there's frost on the hose. He says he doesn't get many customers, 15 a day at most. So right now, these stations are operating at a loss. But they're subsidized by the Japanese government and car makers like Toyota. The company anticipates that governments, including European countries and even perhaps states like Pennsylvania, will respond to the increasing threats of climate change with rules that force car companies to make zero-emission cars. And they think it would be easier for consumers to adapt to filling up a tank with hydrogen rather than charging an electric battery.
Eventually, like all of it, it will be driven by regulation.
Bertel Schmidt is a former car industry advertising executive.
So if a government, a sizable government, tells them, you know, I want my cars to be powered by hamsters, somebody will have hamster farms.
Barring hamster farms, for electric vehicles, the trend today is battery-powered cars. Still, Japan has big ambitions for hydrogen fuel cells. The country hopes to triple the number of hydrogen fuel stations and have 200,000 hydrogen cars, trucks, and buses on the roads in Japan in the next 6 years. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Reporting for this story was supported by the International Center for Journalism. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's state system of higher education is giving its 14 universities more control over tuition rates, which have been the same at each school. Post-Gazette reporter Bill Schachner covers higher education for the Post-Gazette, and he joins us from the Post-Gazette's newsroom. Thanks for taking the time, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bill, give us an idea. What are in-state residents paying to attend one of the 14 state-owned universities these days?
Right now, the state system imposes a base tuition rate for in-state residents of $7,716. The system has set a base tuition rate for better than three decades since its founding. Some schools have begun to deviate from that, but the base rate is still what the majority of in-state residents pay.
Bill, do you have an idea of what the original reasoning was for the same tuition at each of the 14 universities?
These initially were 14 separate, at one point, teachers' colleges. They were, you know, in their own orbits, pursuing their own objectives and goals. There was a thought that unifying those campuses would allow them to lobby for funding as a single entity, and would also provide economies of scales, advantages like that.
Let's face it, the cost for anything can vary from city to city, county to county. Has there been any data to show that the same tuition level impacts students differently depending on which university they attend across the Commonwealth?
Well, what's happened over the years since the system was founded is the fact that these schools operate in very different parts of the state has become apparent in their bottom lines and also in their enrollments. And when you have a single tuition that you charge, it makes it harder for schools in areas where the market is weaker to compete with schools where the market is stronger.
Under this proposal, just how much say will the universities have in determining their tuition? Is there a final ruling at the state level or what?
What the plan is right now is that the system must approve each of the plans, although it is up to the schools to decide what those plans are that will be proposed. And in theory, the idea is simple. A university that's in a part of the state where the population is in decline, the economy is struggling, household incomes are lower, those schools could actually use their newfound freedom to set prices that are actually more affordable for certain students. And conversely, an institution that is offering programs that are in high demand or is just in an area where the population is growing, they could also adjust their rates accordingly.
Bill, the idea of different tuitions, that's been floated around for some time. In July of 2017, you reported that the National Center for Higher Education, among a series of recommendations, suggested that the state board offer a range of tuitions and let the individual schools decide. So why now?
Well, it's interesting. Some people ask, why is it taking so long? With enrollments declining on most campuses, the system set out a couple years back to take a look at itself and sort of redesign what it is and what it does. There was this initial recommendation by a consultant. That proposal suggested that tuition be set in specific ranges. It appears that the system is trying to give universities even more freedom than that by allowing them to create what they want and then bring it to them and see if it passes muster.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, speaking with Post-Gazette reporter Bill Schachner, who covers higher education. We're talking about the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education giving its 14 universities more control over tuition rates. Bill, how does this idea of flexibility in tuition fit into the big picture about stabilizing the entire system?
Well, that's the big question. On the one hand, it's clear that some of these campuses need help financially if they're going to thrive and frankly, if they're going to continue in some cases. One of the big concerns, though, has been what these individual schools will do with these price freedoms. There have been some experiments over the last few years where schools were given more freedom to adjust their rates. And in some cases, costs increased. If you look at the campuses that replaced flat full-time tuition with per-credit tuition, they now are the most expensive of the 14 universities. The difference this time, I think, is that the system seems more committed to the idea that whatever happens should increase access. There has been some research suggesting that lower and even middle-income families in some instances are enrolling less in the universities because what has been happening with price.
Every year, students, parents, they wait for a budget to be passed and a decision whether there'll be an increase in tuition. Is part of this plan to make tuition announcements sooner so that students and parents can better plan?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a part of this too. Right now, because of the way the state sets its budget and the way the universities react to that budget, typically, tuition is not being set until July, which is less than 6 or 7 weeks before the start of the school year. And it makes it difficult for families to plan. They don't know exactly what their costs are going to be until almost it's time to enroll. So the plan is now to allow the schools to set tuition 2 years at a time. The first rate would be set no later than April 30th. That would be a firm rate. The second rate, which would be submitted at the same time, would be a tentative rate for the following year, and that would be subject to some change. But the idea is that it would give families at least a bit more sense of what they are likely to deal with in terms of financing their education.
Do we know how the universities will determine the costs?
Right now, no. Frankly, the universities aren't saying a lot. The system is essentially saying it's up to the universities to decide what they want to do. Another part of this is the fact that these schools now have greater freedom to determine how much financial aid they can provide. So a lot of this is going to depend on how schools use that new freedom. Will they target it to students that are the lowest income? Will they target it to students who perhaps are middle income, but are of the sort that could raise the university's profile?
Final question, Bill. Everybody wants to know when. So when might these different tuitions take effect?
Well, the soonest that it could affect students and families would be the fall of 2020. I think initially the system was hoping to do it as soon as this fall, but I think it became apparent that the amount of planning that was required was just simply not going to make that possible. The big question is going to be, of the 14 schools, how many of them will opt to do this in fall of 2020, and how many will take a wait-and-see approach, or may just simply decide to wait a year or two so they can develop this more fully.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Bill Schachner covers higher education. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, helping young women with eating disorders in the Pittsburgh area through art and other means while confronting the negativity of social media and body shaming. We'll visit with the director of the Renfrew Center in Oakland. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Joya Zenkovic, and Alex Linnigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.